Don't Look Back with Kaz Tran.
And you know when you get that album and you and the songs just go bang, they sit in that groove and you're like, this is so satisfying. And basically your journey through music is trying to chase that sense of satisfaction, that sense of the song fitting in your brain. It just, it ticks all of these boxes.
I'm trying my best to be sweet and domestic. I'm doing the good husband thing. Try to act stable while reading a label, but the SMSs keep flooding in.
Today, Eddie Perfect takes us with him in pursuit of his musical kicks and shares the song that raised the curtain on his creative life. Whether he's inhabiting the persona of Shane Warne or conservative Polly's in Keating the Musical, for him as a songwriter and performer with a huge love of the theatre, the song serves many precise and important functions.
What I love about writing for the theatre and writing music theatre is that, you know, it's the narrative that's being told, and it demands your full attention, and it also demands that you understand it and get something about context and character and emotion and narrative progression in an instant, the first time. You know, obviously some things take a while to go in over a long period of time, but with music theatre, you've only really got that audience for one night, and they have to feel it and understand it in the moment. And I love the challenge of writing that. It's like, I think that's songwriting when it's working its hardest.
Well, it sounds like you're definitely going to be leading to a light bulb moment for a song you want to tell us about, Eddie. What is that one song? Is there a song that's changed your life and continues to, you know, affect you or has left an imprint on you in some way?
Yes, and I, like, you know, obviously the big caveat is that it's really hard choosing one of your children out of a humongous family. But I think, you know, in terms of influence, I remember when my dad brought home a CD player for the first time, and we had, you know, just kind of vinyl records and cassettes. You know, I'd tape songs off the radio onto cassette, and that was how I sort of consumed music. And then I remember when our CD player turned up, and I went down to Brash's and I bought the first compact disc I'd ever bought. I bought Stephen Sondheim's original Broadway cast recording of Company.
Wow.
And you know, that was a very nerdy music theatre thing to do. But I'd say the song that's been most influential off that album really greatly influenced me, because Stephen Sondheim is one of my teachers, even though it's from a very long distance. The song that really captured my imagination was The Ladies Who Lunch. And it kind of comes right towards the end. It's very funny, cynical, dry, older woman character, and I think it played by Elaine Stritch on the original Broadway recording. She's not much of a singer, but by God, you know, she can act through a song. And it's really a tribute to, it's kind of a very bitter, dark, twisted tribute to herself, and it's anthemic. And what I loved about it was there was a lot of references in it that I didn't understand, because some of them were like, some of them were very American and very New York, or you know, it's about these kind of aimless, you know, women who are filling their lives by going to optical art classes, or, you know, going to a matinee or a Pinter play or another piece of Mahler's. And I was like, this is really interesting kind of concepts and interesting sort of, I guess, references that really opened up my brain. But what I loved about it was how the storytelling wound its way around to really being at first a critical song about at specific aimless groups of women, to being very much about criticizing herself. You know, here's to the girls who just watch, aren't they the best? And you know, that another reason not to move, another vodka stinger. It's about her alcoholism. It's about her how easy it is to be detached and judgmental. And I just found it so surprising and so powerful. I mean, it's what anyone that's into music theatre knows the song. They know what an amazing song it is. But I just found it a triumph of lyrics of character and of content, it's just such a surprising and amazing song, and it really sort of laid the bedrock for how I think about writing for characters.
Another long, exhausting day, another $1,000, a matinee, a pinter play, perhaps a piece of Mahler's. I'll drink to that. And one for Mahler. Here's to the girls who play wife, aren't they too much? Keeping house but clutching a copy of Life just to keep in touch. The ones who follow the rules and meet themselves at the schools, too busy to know that they're fools. Aren't they a gem? I'll drink to them. Let's all drink to them.
First of all, being a young boy, first CD that you buy is a 1970s soundtrack. I mean, it's very left field choice. A lot of us would have been buying smash hits, compilations, greatest hits, sort of stuff like that.
Sure, and I did buy those. I'm not going to lie. Yeah, absolutely. I love pop music. I always love pop music. The pop music is similar to music theatre in that its job is really to get you the first time. And that's what makes it kind of wearisome after a while, especially if you're hearing the same song over, because it's sort of a confection and you're like, okay, there's not much to this. And then, I find that the albums that I come back to over and over again are generally live albums, actually, live jazz albums, because there's so many ideas and then there's so much life in them and I find it easier to listen to them. But, a really interesting good pop song is that thing. It's that key in the lock thing where you're like, I never heard this before. You only have to hear Royals once and you're like, it sounds so instantly familiar and the lyrics are so clever, what in music theatre you would call surprising but inevitable.
Yeah.
And it feels like an ageless anthem, but it's also incredibly fresh at the same time because of its lyrical content. And you're like, yep, that's... That's a song. That is a killer song.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies. And I'm not proud of my address. In a torn up town, no postcode envy. But every song's like gold teeth, grey goose.
The character in this song you're talking about from the musical Company, she's judging other people and it's very much a reflection on herself, whether she realises it or not. And a lot of, your material is very much like that. And I thought instantly of some of my best friends are Aboriginal.
That's one of those things where with satire you basically inhabit the persona of the idea or the person that you kind of want to destroy with your argument. And what you try to do is just show how ridiculous their argument is by exploring all the avenues and pathways of kind of ridiculous excess. So, having had an argument with quite a racist guy who ended up saying that some of my best friends are Aboriginal, it just inspired me to want to go, okay, these people that you use that, some of my best friends are gay or some of my best friends are Muslim, as we've heard recently. It's fun to go in there and go, okay, well, let's write a song from that person's perspective, celebrating all the wonderful things about all of their incredible amount of Aboriginal friends. And it's very confusing to people because even if you give a really clear introduction, there's something that's very unsafe about about talking about Indigenous white relations in Australia, because we have this shame that's just underneath the surface.
I have black friends, so I can say whatever I like about them. Sure, they're people I hate, but it's justified because they're my mates.
I think that's where comedy is one of the great art forms. And I know that, across the developed world, I don't think comedy gets the credit it should, because there are some really heavy things that I think you can only talk about in comedy. In fact, well, you know, they're the best. No one wants someone standing on a soapbox, you know, in a toga screaming earnest prose or poetry about, you know, death and murder and how awful we are. That's an ordeal, you know. I'm not interested in that. But if you can, you know, all the greats, people from, you know, from Oscar Wilde through to Molière, and you know, they have this ability to show people themselves and allow themselves to laugh at it. And I think that is really that's really the only way you can get away with it. Isn't there that quote that if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh or they'll kill you?
So this song, The Ladies Who Lunch, what does it mean to you still?
Well, look, I think what it does is it's an example of how, like dramaturgically, a song can do so many things. And not only is it about this character at this time teeing off on other women and then eventually making a very clear and insightful and quite damning appraisal of herself, it's also within the context of the show, she kind of throws herself onto a metaphorical grenade, because the guy that she's friends with, Bobby, the central character, is unable to form any kind of lasting relationship, and he is friends with this series of married couples, of which this woman is a part, and she's been married several times, and she sort of sees it as her job to push him one way or another into taking a risk. You know, he's a very risk-averse person. You know, he can see all the good and all the bad about relationships, but he just hasn't quite made a move towards any one particular reality. And, you know, the resolution of the piece is him singing a song called Being Alive.
Robert, how do you know so much about it when you've never been there?
It's much better living it than looking at it, Robert.
Add him up, Bobby, add him up.
Someone to crown you with love, someone to force you to care, someone to make you come through, who'll always be there, as frightened as you of being alive.
Which is really about, you know, taking the good and the bad and being involved in life and starting a relationship and just seeing what happens. So it's sort of a progression of growth for that male character. And so what that song did for me, I guess, was just make me start to think about all the heavy lifting that a song can do dramaturgically within a script and within a score of a musical, and turn me onto those conversations. And so, you know, when I'm writing music theatre projects, which I am right now with some New Yorkers, you know, you've got this wealth of cultural information that's been laid down by amazing composer lyricists like Stephen Sondheim, and it means that you can have these conversations. The conversations are very, very detailed and nuanced. So, for example, I'm trying to write a song at the moment. It's a duet between a guy, they're both dead, okay, they're both ghosts, and one of them's a man and the other one is a woman, but she is a magician's assistant and she's in two halves, and one of her halves is sort of not there, and it's really kind of a, you know, you're creating a love duet where one guy's trying to understand the mathematics of how that's going to work, because, you know, like, obviously one person plus another person equals two, and when two lovers meet, they become one, and, you know, all of me is into you but only half of you is into me, and breaking it down into fractions, and it's one of the most joyous places to be in songwriting. I mean, I have a lot of people say to me, well, why don't you, you know, you should do contemporary music and you should write albums. And I'm like, I would find that very boring, because the briefs would be so, for me, so open-ended that I wouldn't know where to start. Whereas someone goes, you're going to write a love duet between these two people and one of them has been sawn in half by a magician. And so automatically that's really fascinating to me, because there's a whole bunch of stuff. You know, she obviously can't commit. She would have trust issues. You know, basically her and the magic died on the same night. You know, this guy literally sawed her in half. And it's got metaphors for commitment and all those sorts of things. And so I find those briefs so exciting and so much fun. And I get to use all the, you know, language and images and words that are so far outside the contemporary music world that I just couldn't imagine a world in which I would ever turn my back on that. It's endlessly fascinating and challenging.
These good and crazy people, your friends. These good and crazy people, your merry friends. That's what it's all about.
We've all got a bit of a soft spot for musical theatre, don't we? Eddie Perfect taking us into his great love of the form. Don't Look Back is produced by me, Kaz Tran. If you enjoyed this little journey into how music ticks boxes for Eddie, there's plenty more great chats for you to check out at any time, whenever and wherever you pick up your podcasts. For more music from your past, present and future, head to doublej.net.au. Next week on Don't Look Back, Mick Harvey.
If someone says, you know, finds out if I'm travelling, I'm talking to someone, someone finds out I'm a musician, they go, oh, yeah, what sort of music? If they don't think I'm a complete scumbag because I'm a musician in the first place, then and they ask me what sort of music I play, I'll usually say, oh, it's probably sort of related to some kind of rock music, but it's probably pretty bleak.
For more songs that changed it all, subscribe now to Double J's Don't Look Back podcast.